Can I just say before we begin that for this message this evening, there won't be any points coming up on the screen. I did begin to put together a PowerPoint for it, but there were so many things there. I came to the conclusion it probably actually would have been more of a distraction than a help. So I've dispensed with that for this evening. There's quite a lot in the message tonight, and if you need it again, then I would suggest you either go on the website, listen again, or have a word with one of the media team and get a CD from them. If you want to go through and catch again some of the detail that perhaps you didn't quite get. But if you don't take anything else away with you this evening, I want you to take this, that when Jesus speaks, you ought to listen. And that's the title of this message. When Jesus speaks, listen. Because when Jesus speaks, I trust we will see this evening, he speaks with the authority of heaven. 2 weeks ago, we looked in overview at Mark 13. I put it to you that many people divide up this chapter incorrectly. They say that in verses 5 to 23, Jesus is referring to the destruction of Jerusalem, and then that from verse 24, Jesus begins to speak about his second coming. That's been quite a traditional view. But there's been a strong understanding amongst many Reformed evangelicals in more recent years that that's actually a wrong interpretation of the Bible. And that it's at verse 32 that Jesus begins to speak of his final return. Likewise, in chapter 24 of Matthew's Gospel, where he records the same events, the division there should come at verse 36 of Matthew 24, not at verse 27, as most Bibles show it. And in Luke's account, in chapter 21 of Luke's Gospel, the dividing line should be between verses 33 and 34. Now, some of you might be thinking that these kinds of issues are just for the theologians to argue about. They don't really affect the ordinary believer in the pew. But they do, because these verses are vital in reinforcing the identity and the nature and the authenticity of the Lord Jesus Christ as the Son of God. If he is who he claims to be, then we must expect, actually, we must demand of him that his words are the truth, and that when Jesus speaks, you must listen. Now, if it can be shown that these verses actually contain some teaching that Jesus got wrong, or that somehow he was mistaken, then everything else that he's ever said loses all of its credibility too, surely. If he's got it wrong here, who's to say that he wasn't mistaken elsewhere? I want to try and show you this evening that in this interpretation and understanding of this chapter, and those likewise that you'll find in Matthew and Luke, what I'm laying before you eliminates any possible charge of contradiction or error in the Bible. Something which actually has been the conclusion of even very godly men concerning this chapter. And instead, what we see here in God's word is evidence of the veracity, the credibility of all that Jesus said. So it's important. That affects all of us. So this evening, we're going to look in more detail at verses 5 to 31, and then next week, God willing, in the evening, we'll study the last six verses of the chapter, which do talk about Christ when he returns at the end of all ages. Let me remind you that Jesus is answering the two-stage or the two-part question from the disciples in verse 4. Jesus has told them in verse 2, that Jerusalem is to be completely destroyed. And now the disciples want to know two things. When it will happen, and what signs will issue in the event. And from verse 5 through to verse 31, Jesus addresses their question, and it all relates to the destruction of Jerusalem. And as he concludes in verse 30, he says, this generation, meaning you, this group of people at this time, those people who are alive now, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Now, before we go any further, it's about what will happen to Jerusalem and Israel as a nation. But he's also explaining what will happen to the Christians in Jerusalem as they get caught up in all of these events and finally make their escape to safety. And so we can divide this passage into two basic sections. In verses 5 to 13, Jesus is talking about the intervening years. Everything that will happen from the time he's speaking through to the very beginning of AD 70. And then in verses 14 to 33, he's talking really about what will happen in the final 5 months from April to August AD 70 as the Roman armies attack Jerusalem. So let's look first of all at verses 5 to 13. The intervening years. Roughly 40 years from just after AD 30 through to the beginning of AD 70. Now all through the period covered by the New Testament, Israel and the area of Palestine is a melting pot of political and religious unrest. Has continued to be so to the present day. In Jesus' day, we see Israel having made all kinds of enemies following their conquest of the nations in Canaan and all the surrounding areas. They don't even get on with their close neighbours, the Samaritans. And on top of that, the Romans have piled in and made the whole region part of their empire. And there are so many factions and divided loyalties within Jerusalem, you really can't be sure who you can trust. In the midst of all that, this man, Jesus, has stirred up a whole hornet's nest of trouble for the Jewish and Roman authorities. And just when they think they've dealt with it all, his disciples are now claiming that he's risen from the dead and there's been an explosion of Christianity throughout Jerusalem. And just to make matters worse, the Jews' number one troubleshooter, Saul of Tarsus, has gone and got converted too and joined the other side. Well, you only need to read through the Acts of the Apostles, which spans the years AD 33 through to about 62, to see the fulfillment of what Jesus is talking about in verses 9 to 13. Jesus talks about them being delivered up to councils, beaten in the synagogues, brought before rulers and kings for my sake. When they arrest you and deliver you up, you'll be hated by all for my name's sake. Turn to the book of Acts. Read chapters 6 and 7 as Stephen is martyred by his own people, the Jews. Read chapter 8 as Saul charges through the land, taking the lives of believers. Read chapter 12 as James is beheaded and Peter is thrown into prison. Read chapter 14 as Paul, the apostle now, is stoned and left for dead. Read chapter 16 and see the treatment of Paul and Silas in Philippi. And then in the closing chapters of the Acts of the Apostles, see how Paul, under house arrest, is dragged before a succession of kings and governors. Now most of this persecution, of which Jesus spoke on numerous occasions, came from the Jewish leaders at first, but not only from them. On the 15th of December, AD 37, about 5 years after Jesus spoke these words that we're reading in Mark 13, Lucius Domitius Ahenobarbus was born into a distinguished and noble Roman family. In AD 50, the Roman Emperor Claudius adopted this boy Lucius as his own son. Now, Claudius already had a son of his own. His name was Britannicus. But Lucius, the adopted son, was older than Britannicus, and so took precedence over him in line to the throne. It was at his adoption that Lucius was given his new name, Nero, Claudius, Drusus, Germanicus. And the following year, in AD 51, he was formally named heir apparent by Claudius. Now, just as a little aside, what a wonderful example of the glory of adoption that we have when we realise what it meant for Lucius to be adopted by Claudius, the privileges that he received even above Claudius's natural born son. That's just an aside. In AD 54, Claudius, the emperor, died, most likely poisoned by his wife, Agrippina, clearing the way for Nero to become the emperor. But he wasn't even 17 yet. So at first, Agrippina, Claudius' wife, acted as the consort or the regent. She was quite a woman in Roman history, the sister of Caligula, the wife of Claudius, and the mother of Nero. Quite a CV. But her dominant position didn't last too long. Nero craved power, and she was soon shunted to one side by Nero. And on the 13th of October, AD 54, at the age of 17, he became the Emperor of Rome. On the 11th of February, the following year, Britannicus, the natural-born son of Claudius, died at a dinner party in the palace. Many believed Nero had poisoned him. Nero is described like this: fair-haired, with weak blue eyes, a fat neck, a pot belly, and a body which smelled and was covered with spots. He usually appeared in public in a sort of dressing gown without a belt, a scarf around his neck, and no shoes. His character was a very strange mix. He was artistic, he was sporting, he was brutal, he could be weak, he was sensual, he was erratic, extravagant, sadistic, sexually immoral with both women and men, and later in life almost certainly deranged. Now, at first, probably due to the influence of his tutor, Seneca, he came across as a very humane ruler. The Roman Senate was treated with respect by him. It was granted greater freedom. And later, Claudius was deified, made a Roman god. Sensible legislation was introduced, improving public order. Reforms were made to the treasury. Provincial governors were prohibited from extorting large sums of money from the public to support the games in the arenas. Nero applied himself very diligently to his judicial duties as Roman emperor. He considered ending the killing of gladiators and criminals in the Roman arenas. But although he started well, it didn't last very long. And the turning point was largely due to his own lust and his lack of self-control. And he gradually descended into increasing depths of debauchery and immorality, and from there to great cruelty. He loved the arts. He was actually quite a talented musician and performer. But he would perform on stage and insist that as long as he performed, no one should leave the theatre. It's actually recorded that pregnant women were forced to give birth in the theatre because he wouldn't allow them to leave. And men would pretend to have had a heart attack and died just to get out of the place. Don't get any ideas. In AD 64, he gave his first public musical performance in the city of Naples. But the Romans saw it as a bad omen that the very theatre that Nero had performed in very shortly after was destroyed by an earthquake. Verse 8. There will be earthquakes in various places. There were at least 11 earthquakes in that region during this period, including a big earthquake at Pompeii in AD 63. Then in AD 64, in July, a great fire raged through Rome. Some of you will know about this. It lasted for 6 days. The Roman historian Tacitus, he was about 9 years old at the time, but he reports that of the 14 districts of the city, 4 were undamaged, 3 were utterly destroyed, and in the other 7, there remained only a few mangled and half-burned traces of houses. Now, Nero did rebuild large residential areas of Rome at his own expense, but the people were dazzled by the immensity of the golden palace that he was having built for himself, and they remained very suspicious of him. Well, why is all this of any relevance? Well, it's because Nero craved popularity, and so he looked for scapegoats on whom the fire could be blamed. And he found his scapegoats in an obscure new religious sect, as he saw it, the Christians. And so many Christians were arrested. They were thrown to wild beasts in the Roman arenas. They were crucified. Perhaps one of the most barbaric things that Nero did is covering people in tar and burning them alive, hanging on poles in his gardens at night time as lighting for his parties. And this persecution, on top of the awful treatment that Christians continued to receive at the hands of Jews, as we've seen in the book of Acts, is more than enough to satisfy the words of Christ in verses 9 to 13. Nero's reign ended when he committed suicide on the 9th of June, AD 68, at the age of 30. Now, for much of the time during this period, Rome's anger was directed mainly at the Christians and not the Jews. But there was an ever-increasing undercurrent of anger against Rome that was building up in Jerusalem. And from the around AD 64, around that time, the enmity between Rome and Jerusalem really began to grow with a vengeance. And the Romans began to come down on Jerusalem with increasing force. But note what Jesus said right at the beginning of his speaking to his disciples. Verse 5, he says to them, "Don't be deceived." Verse 7, "The end is not yet." These are going to be dreadful things that you'll see and that you'll experience and that you'll be part of. But don't be deceived, the end is not yet. Israel would have all kinds of skirmishes with her neighbours as well as with Rome, fulfilling the words of Jesus in verses 7 and 8 about wars and rumours of wars and nation rising against nation. It was a real turbulent time for the nation of Israel. There were many earthquakes, as I've already mentioned. There were famines that Jesus speaks of here. One, during the reign of Claudius, the emperor before Nero, is mentioned in Acts 11:28. And what of verse 6? And of verses 21 to 22, what about many coming in God's name, saying, "I am he"? And what about people saying, here is the Messiah, there he is. What about false Christs and false prophets? Well, we know that the apostles, Paul especially, in all of his letters, was constantly warning against false teachers and false prophets. There were many Jewish zealots rising up against Rome. On one occasion, one of them managed to get an army of 30,000 men to follow him, mobilizing them against the Romans. Many claimed to be or were hailed as messiahs. It's recorded for us in other records apart from the Bible. One such man by the name of Simon is recorded in Acts chapter 8. There's one other verse in this section that I haven't mentioned yet, and that's verse 10. And that talks there about the gospel must first be preached to all the nations. Now, some people would say, well, that's talking about now, in these days in which we all live. But we've only got to read through the book of Acts and see, as Peter preaches in Acts chapter 2, he's described there as preaching to men from every nation under heaven. And so these are the intervening years, the first four decades of the church that Jesus is talking about in these opening verses. And the words of Christ are being fulfilled. But this is the run-up to that destruction of Jerusalem, not the actual event. But everything that Jesus has said, we can look back in our history books and see that it is true. And it happened. And when Jesus speaks, we must listen. And then he moves on from verse 14. And he speaks about those final 5 months, April to August of AD 70. Now, following Nero's death in AD 68, over a period of about 18 months, Rome had three emperors who were all murdered. Lots of infighting in Rome. And then a man called Vespasian became the Roman emperor, and the tension between Rome and Jerusalem grew to a new level of intensity. The Roman historian Tacitus and the Jewish historian Josephus was not really a very good guy because he kind of became an ally to the Romans, but they provide harrowing accounts of what would unfold as that conflict between Rome and Jerusalem came to a head. Some of you, those of you that are regularly on your computers, some of you, for your studies, I know, use the program eSword.net. Now, if you go onto eSword, there's lots of things that you can download. One of the things that you can download, well, two of the things, are the works of Josephus. One's called The Antiquities of the Jews, and one is called Wars of the Jews. And if you have a look in Wars of the Jews, you can actually read for yourself in that book all the events that took place during this very time that Jesus is talking about. And you can read in detail some of the harrowing things that took place in Jerusalem. Things came to a head in AD 70, Titus, who was the son of Emperor Vespasian, was the general of Rome's armies, and he besieged Jerusalem. He surrounded the city. He cut them off. It would begin in April, and it would end in August. The Jews fought for their lives, and the conditions inside the walled city of Jerusalem became unimaginable. Rumours concerning those who were trying to do deals with the Romans abounded. And there was actually civil war inside Jerusalem as they were trying to fight the Romans. There was sufficient food inside Jerusalem for them to have been able to survive a siege for several years. But the different factions within Jerusalem fought over the food, and much of it got destroyed, greatly reducing the amount of time that Jerusalem could survive. Verse 20. God shortened the days. Why? In order to save his church. It happened. The words of Christ came true. Because when Jesus speaks, you ought to listen. Back in Jerusalem, the conditions were beyond our imagination, really. Piles of rotting corpses littered the streets. Some streets were virtually impassable because of the mounds of bodies that lay in them. The food supplies ran out. And there's even an account of a woman roasting her own child for food. It was harrowing, harrowing days. The Romans tightened their grip. And in August AD 70, they routed Jerusalem, slaughtering all before them, ransacking the city, before eventually they would burn it to the ground. The Jewish historian Josephus numbers at over a million those who lost their lives, and 97,000 taken into captivity and either sold as slaves or slaughtered for sport in the Roman arenas. The destruction of Jerusalem was called by one historian the most soul-stirring struggle of all ancient history. Just as Jesus said it would be in verse 19. And what of the church in Jerusalem? They knew that when Jesus speaks, you listen. And they had heeded verse 14. When you see the abomination of desolation, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and so on. And those verses speak of the flight of the Christians out of Jerusalem as Titus arrived with the Roman army. And they escaped for their lives. And it's recorded that having taken heed of Christ's warnings, having seen the signs that he gave that told them, these aren't the run-up events, this is the event, get out. They got out. And they fled, some of them literally running from house to house across the flat rooftops, just as we read in Mark 13. And they fled to the town of Pella across the River Jordan, where King Herod Agrippa II gave them asylum. And every believer in Jerusalem escaped with their life before the Roman army actually invaded. Now we read in Mark's Gospel about this abomination of desolation in verse 14. What exactly is that? Well, the same verse in Luke's Gospel, which is verse 20 of chapter 21, tells us the abomination of desolation was the armies of Rome surrounding Jerusalem. Well, why an abomination of desolation? Well, have you seen pictures depicting the Roman armies marching with their ensigns and standards held up high on poles? Perhaps you've seen them in the films with those letters S-P-Q-R. It's Latin. Now, my Latin's no good, but it stands for Senatus Populus K Romanus. The Senate and People of Rome. It was the ancient equivalent, I guess, of CCCP that put the wind up everybody during the Cold War, the Soviet Union. But those standards, you see, that those Roman armies used to carry, they included images of deities that they worshipped. They carried with them their false gods, their idols. And before the temple was destroyed, those images would be carried right into the heart of the temple. False gods and idols worshipped in the temple. An abomination indeed. now. God's people knew that this was the event. Now is the time to run. And they ran. And the church was saved. Now, we've been arguing that all of these verses through to verse 33 are speaking of this one event. And not about the return of Christ at the end of the age. Well, what about verses 24 to 27? Don't they speak of the second coming of Christ? Jesus says, in those days. He's talking about the same period of time. But look at the language people say. The sun will be darkened, the moon not give its light, stars falling. This is the great language of apocalypse. This surely is speaking of the end of the world. Well, no. This is figurative language. It's not literal language. Stars aren't literally going to fall. The sun isn't literally going to be darkened. It's picture language. And it's picture language which is used throughout the Bible to speak of some great earth-shattering event. But it is found throughout the Bible. Let me give you a few examples very quickly. Turn to the book of Isaiah if you want to actually look it up, or you might just want to listen as I read a few verses. First of all, Isaiah chapter 13. Here are some verses speaking about the destruction of Babylon. Verses 9 and 10. Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel with both wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and he will destroy its sinners from it. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened in its going forth, and the moon will not cause its light to shine. That's speaking about the destruction of Babylon. In Isaiah 34, we read about the destruction of a city called Idumea. 34 verse 4. All the host of heaven shall be dissolved, and the heavens shall be rolled up like a scroll, and all their host shall fall down. It's exactly the same language. It's just the kind of picture language that's used to speak of some great earth-shattering event that will take place. You can read something similar in Ezekiel chapter 32, verse 7, which is talking about Egypt. And then what do we read in Acts and chapter 2? This will be a more well-known passage on the day of Pentecost. Peter is preaching and he quotes from the prophet Joel in the Old Testament. He begins quoting at verse 17. But let me just pick it up at verse 19. I will show wonders in heaven above and signs on the earth beneath, blood and fire and vapor of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood. And Peter says, those things are being fulfilled right here in this marketplace right now as the Spirit of God is being poured out. Those things didn't literally happen. It's just figurative language, picture language, describing an earth-shattering event. And back in Mark's Gospel, Jesus says, in those days, after that tribulation, there will be an earth-shattering event. In Mark 13, 24 to 25, the earth-shattering event is the coming to an end of God's special relationship with the nation of Israel. Jerusalem will no longer figure in God's plans. There is a new Jerusalem. There is a new Israel, the Church of Jesus Christ. What about verse 26? They will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory. That surely must be speaking of Christ when he returns. Well, no. This is the language of judgment. not of Christ's literal return. Now, back in Isaiah again, let me just give you one verse from Isaiah. It's the first verse of Isaiah 19. It begins, "The burden against Egypt, God's judgment against Egypt. Behold, the Lord rides on a swift cloud and will come into Egypt. The idols of Egypt will totter at his presence, and the heart of Egypt will melt in its midst." Now, Jesus didn't literally come riding on a cloud. It's picture language, speaking of God's judgment. You can read the same at the beginning of Psalm 97. It's talking about God's judgment. God is exercising his judgment against Jerusalem. These are not just historical things that just happened. God is at work here, and he's exercising his judgment on Jerusalem. Jesus came to his own, and his own did not receive him. When Jesus speaks, we should listen. What about verse 27? "He will send his angels and gather together his elect from the four winds." Well, this surely is the gathering together of God's people at the end of all things. Well, angels are messengers. The Greek word doesn't have to be translated angels. It can be translated messengers. Sent ones. Preachers of the gospel. To gather in his elect. The four winds are the four corners of the earth. Even from this port of Liverpool, men and women have gone out to the four corners of the earth. But it was happening in Jesus' day too. The farthest part of heaven is the furthest place you can think of. The gospel will be universal, no longer restricted to the Jews, but gathered from every tribe, every language, and every nation. And so Jesus concludes, verses 28 through to the end, "Learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So you also, when you see these things happening, know that it is near, at the doors. Assuredly, I say to you," in the Old Testament, God's people said, "Thus says the Lord." Jesus says, "I say." This generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. The destruction of Jerusalem would not plunge the world into winter, verse 28, but into summer, as the gospel is released into the whole world. And you have it today. The good news is of God's grace in Jesus Christ. The God-man who died for sinners to secure our forgiveness and our pardon. The one who says that if the Son shall set you free, you shall be free indeed. And when Jesus speaks, listen.